Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Recent comments by John Hess, CEO of Hess Corporation, offer a rare acknowledgement from within the United States oil and gas industry that the shale revolution may not have staying power. These public statements are rare coming from the oil and gas industry, but they confirm the analysis of earth scientist David Hughes, who's been raising critical doubts about the long-term viability of U.S. shale gas and tight oil production based on detailed analysis of play-by-play production, technological improvements, and geological realities. Today, we're going to talk with David Hughes about the reasons he doubts the long-term viability of shale oil and gas, as well as what it means that an oil company executive is drawing similar conclusions. But first, we're going to spend a few minutes with Jan Zuckerman, one of the Zenith Five, who went to trial last week for blocking the railroad tracks by Zenith Energy at the port last spring. Jan, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara.
Well, since we talked 2 weeks ago on this show, what's happened?
Well, we had the trial, and it was a hung jury, so that means mistrial. Five jurors found us not guilty, and one just got hung up and just could not, you know, couldn't come around.
So he was the hung jury.
Yes, he was the hung juror, for sure.
Let's talk about the trial, though, and what were you trying to prove at the trial? Because you weren't trying to prove that you didn't block the tracks, exactly, were you?
Right. No, we were not. We were not. Well, we were trying to we had the first time, I think, in Oregon, and maybe in the United States, where a judge gave instructions to the jury on the choice of evils defense. So that's what we were really pushing for.
And this is also known as the necessity defense?
Yes.
And I had the impression that one of the trials for the valve turners, I think maybe in Minnesota, they also used that defense and got off?
They were going to, but they were acquitted before. It was dismissed before they were actually able to argue that. So the judge did not get to give those instructions to the jury.
So this was semi-precedent-setting. It was precedent-setting in which, because you actually used this defense in court, but not totally because you haven't gotten a definitive verdict yet.
Right. And I think that, I think there's different interpretations of what was considered a necessity defense. So other folks, I think, in the United States, there's been some talk among us, you know, how many cases were able to use this defense.
So let's explain what that defense means and how you used it in this case.
Basically, we were charged with criminal trespassing. And normally it would just be, did we do it or did we not? And but then the jury was told to apply the choice of evils defense to that. So basically, would our conduct otherwise constitute an offense? Would it be justifiable and not criminal because of this greater harm from Zenith Energy?
And by extension, the threat of climate change.
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, it's definitely, yeah, the threat of climate change.
And how did you feel that the jury was responding? I mean, you were able to watch them, and there were six jurors, right, instead of 12?
Right, there were six jurors. With a misdemeanor, I guess it's six. I felt they were very responsive. When I was up on the stand, I spoke directly to the jury. They listened intently throughout the entire trial, and it was a lot. There's a lot of information to take in.
So what were some of the cases that you made?
Well, gosh, let me think. Mostly that, one of the things that we had to prove is that we tried every other alternative before breaking the law. And I think that, with my testimony, I mean, my background working with youth and over the many, many years of being an activist and being an educator, I've tried everything. I mean, I've gone to Salem. I've worked with City Hall. I've lobbied. I've testified. I've collected. I've petitioned. I've done pretty much every single possible thing I could do. So I think that was a big part of my testimony. And then the work that youth have done.
Yeah, actually, it was impressive. The three that I went to here. Watched the trial on Wednesday, and so you and my corner and Margaret Butler, who actually were the contingent that I had on the show 2 weeks ago, I got to hear you all testify. And Mike Horner has a rather impressive resume going back, I don't remember how long, back to those days when he's living in Maine, being an activist. And then Margaret's is not quite as long as Mike's, but certainly she's been active very long. And I found it interesting, Mike was kind of like an all-round activist. Margaret really focused on the labor union, labor movement, until she retired and then became a climate activist.
Right.
And you are, your focus was on youth. And I wonder how those three strengthened each other, those three kind of courses to come to the same place.
Right. Well, they definitely did. I mean, I think it was good for the jury to see all of those components, you know, all of our different backgrounds leading us to the same place.
And what happens now?
Well, on Wednesday, we have a date in court to set the next trial dates. So it'll depend on whether the district attorney, the state of Oregon, wants to retry us. We're assuming, you know, we're ready. And I personally am looking forward to that. But they could decide to dismiss. So it'll be up to them.
So if they were to dismiss, would that be a victory for the necessity defense?
Well,
or has it become unclear again?
Yeah, it becomes unclear again. I mean, a victory would be that it's law, you know, that we, anybody could use it. No one would have to fight to use the necessity defense, that it would be that it actually would be written into law, I think. I'm not sure how that all works, but we'd like to have an acquittal for sure. That would be a greater victory, but I still think that we had a victory.
Because that was one of the things that was kind of being chatted around, particularly in social media after the trial, was some people were calling it an outright victory, some people were calling it a partial victory. So what was your feeling? I mean, when you texted me on Thursday night, I guess, to say that it was a hung jury, and I felt this kind of letdown, actually. I couldn't tell from, it sounded like a letdown on your part, too, and then we got a little bit more information. But it wasn't until I started reading other people's, including your lawyer's statements, it sounded like, well, maybe this isn't so bad. So I just wonder how much of a victory you feel you're at this stage in the process.
Yeah. I mean, for sure, it was an initial disappointment. Having all six jurors declare our innocence would have felt better, but five out of six, it feels very strong, and we didn't get convicted of blocking the oil train. So to me, that's a huge victory, and so, you know, there was some disappointment, but for sure, we felt like that's much better than being found guilty.
Now, there's been some media coverage of this, it seems. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we were sitting in trial on Wednesday and people were looking around going, where's the media? There was me.
Right.
And there was a woman I was sitting next to from Inside Climate News who was the most amazing typist I've ever watched. And I'm curious to see what story she wrote. And I said to her at one point, you're the only national media here. And she acknowledged that. Mm-hmm. I guess the TV came for the verdict. I mean, somebody was there. And then the Oregonian showed up and wrote an excellent article.
Right.
But how much media coverage did you get then, and how much more have you gotten since then?
I think we're getting more. We're hearing more from media now after the trial. And so we'll see. I was listening to OPB after the trial, and about with the reporting of, I think, 1% of all reporting is focused on climate. That's like 4 hours out of the whole year that reporters focus on climate.
They said that on OPB?
Mm-hmm.
That's good for them to say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they were interviewing someone who said that. So they I can't remember who the person was. I think it was on the science focus.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's shocking to me. I didn't really think about it that way, but I think it's clear. I mean, it really shows.
I mean, it's interesting because actually it seems like we've been getting a lot more coverage about climate. And I would say in the last 3 or 4 months, it's been a lot more than 1%. I mean, now it's all eclipsed by coronavirus.
Right.
Which for all we know has a climate connection. Who knows?
Right.
But it does seem like there's been an opening of discussion. And that's how I wonder how you see that the trial fits into that and can continue to push the envelope.
Right. I mean, for sure there's a shift. And this is the kind of whittling away, or the breaking down of, you know, trying to break down that fear of talking about it, I guess. Or for me, a friend of mine said, we're all in a coma. And when we get out of this coma and we feel the pain of what's happening, it's hard. It's you know, we're all in despair. So to report about that is hard. And I think that more and more people are willing, and it's real. I mean, it's happening. We can't deny it. So I think that we're going to hear more. We're shifting.
Well, I feel like the thing for me that makes a difference is that if I feel like I'm engaging and I'm with people who are engaging and really heading this problem, facing it head on, it gives me, I'm not sure if it gives me hope, but it gives me a sense of power.
Right.
And I don't know. I mean, none of us know if we're really going to be able to make an impact. But as long as you're working towards trying to make that change, I think it does make an impact.
Yeah, it's too overwhelming if you're alone in it. But yeah, I went to a rally right after the trial. There was an XR Extinction Rebellion rally in front of City Hall. That was wonderful. And you know what? One thing that Mike Horner said is, you know, courage is contagious, and that's what we have to have, is a lot of courage. And this trial is part of that.
Well, keep us posted on what happens on Wednesday, and we'll continue to report on this.
So thanks
a lot for joining us. Mm-hmm. We've been just talking with Jan Zuckerman, who's one of the Zenith Five, who went to trial last week for blocking the railroad tracks by Zenith Energy at the Port of Portland last spring. And now we're going to be joined by David Hughes. David Hughes is a Canadian earth scientist who's been raising doubts about the long-term viability of U.S. tight oil and gas, shale gas production. David, welcome to Locus Focus.
Oh, pleased to be here.
We're going to be talking now about the possible demise of the oil industry, having just talked to an activist who is trying to block tar sands trains from coming through Portland. And there's two things happening. One is that there's actually, as we'll go into more detail, a reduced amount of oil and gas that can be extracted from the shale formations that have been the big boon to U.S. fossil fuel production in the last couple decades. But there's also a real growing climate movement, which is really raising awareness about why we need to keep this in the ground. And I wonder how you see these two forces coming together.
Well, in terms of oil or shale oil production in the U.S., it hasn't actually started to decline, but it looks like it's going to plateau. And it looks like the capital is needed to be plowed into those places to keep production flat is going to become a lot more difficult. As for the emissions end of it, I'm Canadian, as you know. I've looked at, you know, oil sands emissions and the forecasts of the government out to 2040. And in terms of climate and emissions, it's pretty much a train wreck. You know, if in fact that much oil and gas was produced. I've also looked at the U.S. government forecasts, which in general tend to be very optimistic. I don't think that they're achievable in any way, shape, or form, particularly if you look at, you know, what's been happening recently with the difficulty of shale players getting capital. So, you know, that's a good thing in terms of the climate. If the U.S. government forecast actually proved accurate, that would be devastating for the climate.
So I want to go back a little bit and just kind of talk about more or less the geology of these plays, as they're called, and to explain to listeners who really don't know much about how oil and gas are removed from the earth, talk about where they are and how they are, how the oil and gas is accessed. And the issues that are being faced as these plays start to run out.
Well, if you look at oil, for example, shale oil, tight oil, it's actually, you know, only concentrated in about four major plays. There's the Bakken of North Dakota, the Eagle Ford down on the Gulf Coast in southern Texas, and the Permian Basin, which is in West Texas and the southeast corner of New Mexico, as well as the Niobrara in Colorado and Wyoming. So there's only those four big ones. And if you look at, you know, the evolution of fracking, which is really what it's all about, you know, to give the engineers credit, they have made a lot of technological improvements. over the years, and those improvements have really been longer horizontal laterals. You know, if you look at the Bakken in North Dakota, the horizontal portion of those wells is 2 miles long. They've also radically increased the amount of water and prop they're injecting into those wells. So, you know, a typical well in the Bakken would take 20 million gallons of water. So you're putting like 2,000 gallons of water per foot into those wells, just to give you an idea of how aggressive the technology is. And 2,000 pounds of mostly sand, but also chemicals, which is called a proppant, per foot into those wells. So, you know, very aggressive, very expensive. You know, an average Bakken well is close to $8 million. And the nature of shale plays is that they decline quickly. So if you drill an $8 million Bakken well, it will probably decline about 70% in production in the first year, and it could be down 85 to 90% after 3 years. Typically, the decline rate flattens off as the wells get older, but the production is a very tiny fraction of what it was initially. So this means that you have to keep drilling, and you have to keep plowing in a lot of capital. And that's what's becoming more and more difficult. Your shale gas is the same thing. There's quite a lot of what they call associated gas that comes with tight oil in the Permian Basin and also the Eagle Ford, a little bit in the Bakken. But the really big shale plays are further east, the Marcellus in Pennsylvania and West Virginia, the Utica, mainly in Ohio. Those are really big shale gas plays, but they produce almost no oil. And again, the same technology is being used, much more aggressively employed. But if you look at, you know, the geology of a typical shale play, if you look at the Bakken, for example, it covers 15 counties of North Dakota, but over 90% of the oil is produced from four of those counties. And that's called the core area, or the sweet spot. And that's where companies have been pouring in the wells and the money. However, you can only drill so many wells. You know, if you look at the Permian and you look at the sweet spots, the wells are becoming overcrowded. And once that happens, you know, one well begins to cannibalize production from another. And overall well productivity goes down. And that's starting to happen in slow shale plays.
Now, I want to kind of break in for a second, because I think, I'm not sure how many listeners understand how important the horizontal part of the drilling, horizontal drilling, that piece of what fracking involves. So can you sort of describe what actually happens? You put a drill bit down vertically first, and then what happens when you start drilling horizontally, and how does that limit how close individual wells can be from each other?
Well, typically, you know, if you have a pay area that's, say, 100 feet thick and 10,000 feet down, they'll drill vertically 10,000 feet, and then they'll bend that well horizontally. And the technology is so good that you can follow a 100-foot thick formation for 2 miles on a horizontal track. And so you're accessing 2 miles of formation, productive formation, with that horizontal leg of the well. Whereas, you know, in the good old days, say more than 20 years ago, most of the wells were vertical. And with a vertical well, you can only access the 100-foot thickness. So that's the real revolution, just the technology to be able to drill horizontally and to control the position of the drill bit. You have to admit, it's pretty spectacular technology. But when you pump that amount of water and sand per foot into the well, you know, the fractures radiate out. They may go out several hundred feet. And if you drill a well closer than, you know, the radius of those, the fracture length that goes out from the horizontal well, then the fractures from adjacent wells start to interfere with one another. And so one well is really cannibalizing the reservoir of another, and production starts to fall. And if production falls, I mean, you know, the economics of these wells, you spend $7.8 million on a well, the only way it makes economic sense if the price is high enough to, you know, get your money back plus a profit. But if wells start interfering with one another, less oil comes out, and you make less money, and eventually you start to lose money unless the price of oil is high enough. And that's starting to happen in these major shale plays.
So what's the upshot of that? I mean, is there a way that the oil companies can continue to find ways to drill, or is there at some point a limit to how many drill pads they can put down on these plays? And is there any place else they can go at this point?
Well, like I said, the Bakken is 15 counties in total, but four counties are the sweet spot. You know, when you drill a well there, you get very high productivity. And, you know, you can drill maybe four wells per square mile in the Bakken. It's not worth putting any more than that because they interfere with one another. And so once you fill up the core area or the sweet spot with wells, then you have to start moving out into the other 11 counties, which don't have as good a quality reservoir. And therefore, even though the wells cost the same amount of money to drill, the productivity falls off. And, you know, at some point, it's just not profitable to drill a well unless the price of oil goes up a lot. And what's been happening in shale plays up until now is they've been improving the technology, and they've been focusing on the sweet spots. And in some plays, the sweet spots are just about gone. And, you know, once that happens, we're going to see shale production start to fall off. It just doesn't make any economic sense anymore to drill.
So you did a study recently, and you were looking at the data coming from the United States Department of Energy's Energy Information Administration, and they published their annual Energy Outlook, which reviews U.S. energy sources and forecast supply through 2050. You had some issues with that. First of all, when did you do the study?
I've done several of them, but the most recent one was published in November of 2019.
And what did you find with the data that you were looking at?
Well, you know, if you could meet the EIA's forecast in that particular study, you need to drill about 1.4 million wells by 2050 at a cost of somewhere around $10 trillion. You know, if you could put that many wells into those plays. And I went through the plays one by one and calculated, you know, the number of wells that the U.S. government was counting on putting into them. And, you know, what would make sense in terms of the play area and how dense the wells would be if you put that many wells in. I found in most of the plays that they were wildly optimistic. You know, out of the 13 plays I looked at, I classified 9 of them as extremely optimistic in terms of the U.S. government forecast, which means that, you know, there's probably a lot less there than we're being told by the government.
Now, where did you get your data?
At a price that makes sense.
So where did you get your data?
My data comes from a commercial database, which is also used by the U.S. government. It's a company called Drilling Info out of Austin, Texas.
So you're basically looking at the same data that the U.S. Department of Energy is looking at. Why do you think you have such different opinions about what the data represents?
Well, it's, you know, I think to a certain extent, those government forecasts are somewhat political. I mean, you know, politicians don't want to be told that we have a problem, you know, in the nearer term. I mean, the EIA forecasts pretty optimistic production out to 2050. And in some cases, they've recovered more oil by 2050 in their forecasts than they actually say exist. If you look at proven reserves and unproven, technically recoverable resources, you know, and how can that be? You can't recover more oil than your own estimates say are there. So I think, you know, part of it is political. Myself, I don't have any axes to grind. I just, you know, look at the data itself, and you know, that's how I make my estimates.
So it seems like it's self-defeating on the part of the U.S. government to be promoting the myth that there's all this oil out there. I mean, ultimately, somebody's going to be having to pay for it. And it sounds like the oil companies are at least becoming aware of this themselves. So I'm wondering, as an outside researcher, basically, do you have any motivation to make public and to maybe make public to the government this contradiction you're seeing between your own research and what they're saying?
Well, yeah, all my reports are public, and certainly the U.S. government has seen them. So, you know, I'm sure they have the data. It's just that now we're seeing, you know, like the press release that you got in order to invite me here. From what John Hess, who's the CEO of Hess Corporation, which is a big tight oil producer in the Bakken, you know, is basically saying that the same thing that I've been saying. You know, the writing looks on the wall from his own drilling results. And, you know, other senior executives have said the same thing, most recently by the CEO of Schlumberger, which is a major service company to the oil industry.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with David Hughes, a Canadian earth scientist who's been raising doubts about the long-term viability of U.S. tight oil and shale gas production. So what does it mean to you that representatives and high officials in the oil and gas industry are starting to say the same thing you're saying, and who's listening to them?
Well, I think that, you know, people would certainly listen to John Hess more than they would David Hughes. But basically, we're both saying the same thing. So it's important that industry is coming clean, basically. You know, certainly we're going to produce a lot more tight oil and shale gas. But, you know, we know the emissions implications of doing that, which are terrible. We know what we have to do climate-wise, which is basically ramp down production. You know, that will make a big difference in terms of emissions. So, you know, why are we assuming that we have, you know, infinite amounts of this stuff for decades to promote business as usual when we know that business as usual is, you know, very bad in terms of emissions and climate? You know, what we do need is a policy that, you know, looks as realistically as possible at what might happen, you know, over the next couple of decades. And over-optimism, you know, may be good if you're a company trying to sell stock to shareholders. But in terms of the people of the U.S. and, in my case, Canada, you know, the more reality we have, the better.
Well, we are troubled in this country specifically by having presidential administration that just wraps itself in lies, and whether we're talking about the abundance of coal or the lack of concern about the coronavirus, it seems like there's a big tendency on the part of the Trump administration and on the part of Trump himself to just deny the inevitable and to be trying to create a fictitious picture to win people over and believe that everything's going to be good the way it always was. So it seems like we have this rather big force we have to overcome in order to get the word out. I wonder if there's, if you have any idea of like what kind of pushback John Hess and other people in the oil industry have gotten from government high-ups about letting out the secret that we are actually going to be running out of accessible oil and gas.
That's a very good question. You know, the statements by John Hess came out in early February, and I haven't heard anything about pushback. You know, I think President Trump is going to, you know, no amount of wishful thinking will change reality, unfortunately. And, you know, some of his narratives are basically wishful thinking. And reality always has the last word. You know, if you're aware of the way things are likely to unfold, you know, over the next few years, that would allow you to make a policy that was much less painful to the citizens that are, you know, are looking at those forecasts. But reality will definitely have the last word, you know, regardless of what President Trump says.
Well, another reality has to do with investors. And this is a little fuzzy in my mind. I know that there have been major banks that are pulling back on certain fossil fuel investments, and I don't have the specifics in front of me, but it does seem that if it's really going to be bad finance to continue to put money into continuing oil and gas exploration in the shale plays, what do you see is going to be the continuing response from the financial industry?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, there's been a lot of divestment, you know, out of fossil fuels completely by, you know, some hedge funds, different bankers. J.P. Morgan, I think, just came out in the last few weeks. And basically, that's the death knell. You know, just to offset field decline in the Bakken, you need close to 1,000 $7.8 million wells. So that's, you know, roughly $8 billion a year have to go into that play just to keep production flat. And if you can't get the money, and a lot of these shale producers have negative cash flow, so they're not making any profits, and they're not very attractive to investors. And as soon as you stop drilling, you know, in the back, and if you stop drilling, your production would fall about 35% in 1 year. So without that constant stream of investment, production will go south very quickly.
So you're saying basically you have to keep drilling new wells because the old wells are just not going to be continuing to produce anything.
Well, they'll produce at very low rates. I said, you know, in the first 3 years, a Bakken well might decline 90%. So it's still producing 10% of what it did when you drilled it. But you need to drill a lot more wells to make up for that decline. And, you know, in the case of the Bakken, it's about $8 billion a year. Every play has its field decline rates. If you look at a play like the Haynesville shale gas play in Louisiana, you know, the field decline is about 40%. So you have to drill enough wells to replace 40% of production every year. It's a wicked treadmill, and it takes an awful lot of capital in order to keep that going. And it is looking like, you know, investors are getting sick of it. You know, negative cash flow, no returns, and, you know, why are they putting their money into this? So I think it's going to get more and more difficult.
So if J.P. Morgan isn't going to finance these companies and the other two, I don't remember if it's Citibank, Chase, I don't remember which ones it was besides J.P. Morgan, but there were two before J.P. Morgan pulled out. So if they can't get any financing, where do they go at this point? Deutsche Bank?
Well, then it goes south very quickly. You know, if funding dried up. You know, these so-called junk bonds that shell companies are issuing have pretty high rates of return, you know, if they can pay the interest. There's been a lot of bankruptcies. I think there's been over 200 bankruptcies of shell companies since 2015. So, you know, then investors lose everything. And there's been more and more signals that, you know, we're not interested so much in growing production. We're interested in cash flow, positive cash flow, if you want us to put more money into your companies. And, you know, that's becoming more and more and more difficult as time goes by.
So where do you see this leading to? I mean, do you think that this is going to really just dry up the oil and gas industry if they can't drill anymore and they can't get any more funding?
Well, certainly I don't think it's going to stop. But drilling rates may fall below the level that they need to be to even maintain production. You know, that's what John Hess was saying, is basically in the Permian. He sees the Permian plateauing within a couple of years. You know, back in probably the same thing. So there'll still be drilling. There'll still be an industry for, you know, probably decades. But production will, you know, will just keep inexorably falling. And if the U.S. aspires to, you know, keep burning the same amount of oil and gas that it burns today, then it's going to have to start importing, you know, a lot more of its resources.
So, I mean, that would be the only way for the oil companies, the domestic oil companies, to stay alive is to start importing oil again?
Right. And certainly, the majors, you know, like the Exxons and the BPs and the Shells, you know, they have global interests. And shale is primarily a North American phenomenon at this point. There's a little bit in Argentina, a little bit in China. But it's mainly the U.S. And that, you know, the U.S. shale boom has really been responsible for most of the global growth in oil production. But once it starts to dry up, you know, if you look at, say, the average shale pit play may decline 30 to 40% per year. If you look at overall oil production in the world, globally, the declines that aren't shale are only about 6% per year. So, you know, outside of the U.S., declines are much, much lower. Plus, there's quite a few places to look yet in terms of, you know, more profitable places to put your money than U.S. shale. So, you know, as soon as people start not to invest in the U.S., shale production is going to go south very quickly, just because of the nature of the beast. The U.S. is going to have to import a lot more oil, or, you know, get a lot more sensible in terms of, you know, climate change, how it generates energy, and so forth going forward.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about that in just a bit, but I kind of wanted to continue on with this thread about where we get our oil. What connection do you see between the declining amount of oil that can be drilled from the shale plays in the United States and the gargantuan effort to get as much of the tar sands oil out as possible from Alberta?
Well, yeah, the tar sands are a big deal, and the U.S. is the biggest importer of tar sands on the planet. You know, one of the reasons for that is, you know, Canada aspires to build pipelines to Tidewater, but it's had it's had trouble. But the U.S. needs the oil. And one of the things about tar sands is it's very heavy. And when you put that into a refinery, you get, you know, heavier products like diesel fuel, certain things that you can't get out of shale oil. Shale oil is generally very light. You know, they have what's called the API gravity of oil. And if you look at, West Texas Intermediate, it has an API gravity of say, around 36. But light oil out of the Bakken is up around 45. And there's only, you know, you can make gasoline out of it and some lighter products, but things like high yields of diesel fuel, you need heavy oil. So the U.S. is a big importer of heavy oil from Canada, the tar sands, also heavy oil from Venezuela and Mexico, because a lot of refineries in the Midwest and also on the U.S. Gulf Coast are set up to process heavy oil, so they can't use the light oil that's coming out of these shale plays. And a lot of the light oil is now exported to other countries. So the U.S. is still, you know, quite a big importer of heavy oil, but it's also quite a big exporter of light oil, just because refineries in the U.S. are saturated with this stuff. So, you know, one of the things about tar sands is if you invest, you know, 10 or 20 billion in a mine, then it produces at a constant level for 40 years. It's not like shale, you know, where you have to just keep drilling in order to maintain production. But, you know, the emissions of doing that are, you know, are atrocious. The same with most oil and gas production. So, you know, big, huge conundrum. Like right now, Canadian emissions, about 26% of Canadian emissions come from upstream oil and gas production. You know, tar sands, natural gas, conventional oil. And that's forecast to keep growing as tar sands grow in the future. Yet the Canadian government tells us that it's going to be net zero in emissions by 2050. Well, there's absolutely no way that can happen. You know, the Canadian government is looking at LNG export terminals. I've just finished a report on that. And, it's absolutely a train wreck. If you look at BC, they're constructing an LNG terminal at Kitimat. And just that one terminal, the emissions that oil and gas production in BC in general, you know, projected out to 2050, just that one terminal will basically mean all the rest of BC's economy has to shrink emissions to zero by 2034. And, you know, after that, oil and gas production will still be about double their 2050 emissions target. They're looking at reducing emissions 80% from 2007 by 2050. So, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric about doing something out of governments on climate change, but if you do the math, it just absolutely doesn't work. When you contrast that with the oil and gas production forecast.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with David Hughes, a Canadian earth scientist who's been raising doubts about the long-term viability of U.S. tight oil and gas production. Before we get into like some other ways we should be emphasizing looking towards our energy future, I just want to talk a bit about this, it seems like a glut of natural gas, which is coming from Canada and which is trying to find outlets in the Pacific Northwest, either through the LNG facility that they want to build in Tacoma, the methanol refinery in Kalama, or the humongous LNG export facility they want to build at Jordan Cove in Coos Bay, Oregon. And this is based on the presumption that there's going to be endless gas coming from British Columbia and a great impetus to get it out now. Do you think that the gas that's coming out of British Columbia, which is also being fracked, is going to be played out in the same way that the oil plays are here in the United States?
Yes, 98% of the gas that comes out of Canada now is fracked. You know, if you look at all of the other gas production in Canada, it's going down. So really fracking has really allowed Canada to maintain its production. And if you look at all the provinces in Canada, only BC is forecast to grow significantly. And all that is fracked gas from northeast BC. You know, personally, right now, I think the Pacific Northwest gets a little over half of its gas from Canada. And quite a bit of the rest, I think, from Colorado and, you know, further east. But frankly, you know, if you look at the pipeline capacity, I don't think that there's enough gas to supply any LNG facilities in the Pacific Northwest from Canada. Maybe they'll be able to crank up supply from further east in the U.S., but, you know, there's a huge LNG terminal under construction that I mentioned at Kitimat. And that's going to take up virtually all the growth in gas production in BC, just to provide that. So I don't know where the gas would come from.
Well, it's kind of interesting because the facility they want to build in Tacoma, which they've actually built the holding tank already for, they built it before they got a permit. And they got their final supplemental environmental impact statement approved and finalized under the condition that all the gas that would feed it would be coming from British Columbia, because according to this study that they did, which was rather fallacious, British Columbia gas leakage rates were much lower than any place else, which is debatable. And they were using very old data from the Canadian Association of Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers. So what do you think of that? I mean, can Tacoma LNG rely on getting its total source of gas, which is going to be quite a bit of gas, from Canada for the lifetime of the plant, which is to be 2040 or 2050?
Not from BC, I wouldn't think. You know, I highly doubt it.
Yeah,
They're looking at almost doubling BC's gas production just to feed the Kitimat LNG facility. It's called LNG Canada. So I don't see where there would be a lot of gas left over to feed, an LNG plant in your area. I wonder if the forecast the company used actually considered, you know, the latest gas production forecast for Canada came out in early December. I wonder if they looked at that, if they even knew about LNG Canada that's being constructed in Kitimat and so forth. It'd be interesting to have a look at their proposal.
I could actually send you the final environmental impact statement that they and the life cycle analysis that they used. If you're interested in studying, I'll send it to you, and I'll be interested in getting your feedback on it. I mean, it was very questionable. That was one of the issues that was raised by opponents of this facility, is that there's no way of knowing that the gas is going to come from Canada, and they had no control over where the gas was going to come from. Interestingly, I'm not sure the pipeline situation to get it up to Tacoma. I mean, the thing is that right now there aren't that many pipelines that go from Colorado or go past like eastern Oregon that would get gas to the coast, whether it's to get to Jordan Cove or whether it would be to pipe it back up to the Puget Sound area. So there's these very questionable pipelines that are being fought. But I think that the discussion about the impact of the Kitimat LNG facility, which people have been talking about, I know the opponents know about it. I'm not sure if Puget Sound Energy knows about it. So we can pursue that a little bit later. Well, I'd like to talk more about what are these alternatives and how do we use the information that the fossil fuel industry production is plateauing to really make a case for leaving the rest in the ground.
Well, I think that leaving the rest in the ground has to be made from the climate emission side of it. You know, I think that there's going to be far less pulled out anyway, just because of economics, than people think is going to be pulled out. And, you know, if one had a realistic understanding of how much that is, how much money it's going to take to produce what is producible, then the economics of doing something about the climate may look a lot better, right? You know, for example, the study that I produced in November suggested something over 1.4 million wells would be needed, you know, if it was possible to meet the EIA forecast at a cost of $10 trillion. You know, $10 trillion would probably go a long ways if it was, at least part of that was applied to emissions reduction, alternative forms of energy generation, and so forth.
So that's what we should look forward to, is putting
Really, you know, it's like, I've been, you know, after the government in Canada to have a rational energy policy that included climate, you know, that put the whole thing together. But, you know, governments are elected on a four-year cycle. And they think if they can make a quick buck on an LNG facility or a new oil sands mine, you know, they'll be gone before the consequences of doing that ever hit home. So you really need a more holistic, longer-term view of what reality is, and just the nature of governments elected on, you know, four-year cycle seems to be that they don't want that long-term view, but it's absolutely desperately needed in terms of, you know, managing what happens to this planet.
Well, it seems that the climate movement is definitely looking to the long-term view and having a lot of their leadership coming now from indigenous communities. Maybe that will spill over into the mainstream. We'll see how the next election goes in the United States, and it might be time for Canada to have some more elections too.
Yeah, I'm going to be really interested to get a reaction out of governments of this LNG report, which are just finished, which basically incorporates the latest forecasts, the latest emissions data, runs it all out to 2050. And it's basically just an absolute horror show, you know, from an emissions point of view, from surface land use point of view, if you look at the number of wells, pipelines, roads that would have to be constructed. So, you know, I'm hoping that will have an impact. You know, we'll see.
Well, I'd like to get a copy of it when you finish it, and I'd like to send it on to some people who are fighting the LNG projects here. So I want to thank you very much for joining us, David. It's been interesting talking to you, and particularly learning more about that Kitimat terminal that I've only heard rumors about. So thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
We've been talking today with Canadian Earth scientist David Hughes, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll talk with Tom Carpenter about Hamford's latest horrors. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Tom Waits. Thanks for listening.
a man will try to drown. And it's the rain that they predicted. It's the forecast every time. The roses died because you picked it. I believe that friend is mine. And the road runs strangers. Talk only about the weather. All over the world, it's the same.